one Football World Cup, a Netball World Cup, a Cricket World Cup, the Ashes, another Ashes, the Anniversary Games, Formula One. It's been a quiet summer, hasn't it? Well, listeners, after several special episodes and a waiting time that could only be rivaled by a Conservative Party leadership election, we are back. We're kicking off with a rugby guest, we have the latest news, and we're also taking a dive into the world of gambling. Welcome to Sportspiel. Yes, listeners, it has been far too long, almost 2 months, in fact, since we last actually sat down together to record an episode. That was one of our FIFA World Cup special episodes. But it's a hello from me and a hello from Mr. Will Moulton over there.
We're back! Exciting times.
Yeah, we were just chatting before we started recording. 3 months since our last regular episode?
Nearly 3 months, and that was with Danielle Brown as our special guest.
Yes. So, even though we've pumped out quite a few special episodes since, this is episode 39, following on from episode 38, back in May.
Sorry.
How's life been anyway?
Cause life has been busy. Nuts. Obviously, with the conclusion of the Pro League, that took over my life in May and June. Hockey just rules, apparently. And then a holiday, so I was away for 3 weekends, effectively. And then just watching lots of sport on the TV or sometimes in the stadium as well. And it's been brilliant. It's been non-stop.
Loved decent it. Summer, as I said in my intro.
And no Premier League football, which has been really nice as well. We've been able to focus on other events, other sports.
No matter how much people have tried to ram pre-season tours down your throat. But yeah, likewise, very busy. I got to go to one of the Pro League games. Thank you for that.
You did indeed.
It was a good game as well.
Was that the men's game against the Dutch when we scored a last-minute equaliser? Yep.
And then lost in the shootout. But still, yeah. Needed that 1 point, didn't you?
Yep. It's a very crucial point.
Very crucial point. And yes, I've had exams since we last recorded, which I passed. Yay.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I now have a new role, a new job at the same place that I was at before. But now I edit things. So yay.
All of the fun.
All of the fun. Anyway, on this episode, we are delighted to bring you another feature interview, since that's what we're all about on this podcast. This time, Will spoke to Leeds Rhinos' Caitlin Beavers. After that, on this episode, we've got the news roundup, as we always have when we're back to our regular format. And then we have our discussion section after that, where we are going to be looking at gambling advertising in sport. That is because the pre-watershed ban of gambling advertising during live sporting events came into effect, so the current Ashes series is the first UK major sporting event to have that ban as part of the televised package. But all of that is to come. We also have Ask Alistair as well, my favourite part.
You love it.
I do love it. That is to come as well. But first, introducing his guest is Mr. Will Moulton.
Any regular followers of the 52 blog will know how much of a fan I am of Caitlin Beavers. She shot into sort of national headlines last year when she became the first woman ever to referee a rugby league game at Wembley Stadium. She was just 16 at the time. She is now a two-time Challenge Cup winner with Leeds Rhinos. She's also played internationally for England as well and is really ripping up the scene of rugby league. And it's fantastic for us as well to delve into another sport. But alongside her playing capabilities, as we mentioned before, she's such a fantastic role model for women who are so underrepresented in terms of being officials in sport, and she's really paving a way for them there in a sport that's so traditionally seen as male only. So fantastic interview coming up, and make sure you stick around. Welcome back to episode 39, listeners. And after the big build-up I gave her before the short break, I'm delighted to welcome Caitlin Beavers to the show. So first of all, Caitlin, thank you for agreeing to speak to us, and it's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
There are so many places I'd love to start this interview, and as anyone who reads the 52 blog knows how much of a fan I am of yours, but I guess we'll go with the most recent piece of news that was made public just a few hours before we spoke, in that you have been selected as part of the England side to play Papua New Guinea and compete in the inaugural Rugby League World Cup Nines tournament later this year. So first of all, congratulations, and how did it feel when you got the call?
The massively shocked. If anything, I only expected to go on one at the most. But yeah, like I said, I was massively shocked, and I did not expect to get the phone call for either of them. Obviously it's something really, really special, and it's an absolute honour to get an opportunity to represent my country again.
And not just an opportunity to represent your country, but also to make part of rugby league history with the first ever nines tournament. Have you played much of that format of the game before?
No, I've never played nines, but the sound of it excites me. A full pitch with only nine players beside, a lot of space to have a lot of fun during a game. So, no, I've never done it before, so looking forward to a new challenge.
Is it fair to say that it's sort of the equivalent of what rugby sevens is to the 15-a-side rugby union, and that in that it's going to be a lot quicker, the game's going to be shorter, there's going to be sort of multiple games played in a day?
Yeah, I think there are 7-minute games, and it is just 9-a-side and full pitch. So it's like you said, it's just quick paced games, no breaks hardly.
And do you think perhaps that's one way that can be make the game even more attractive, is sort of the quicker, shorter, sharper, more exciting games?
You could see that throughout the whole world competition, because not everyone, like, there's so many different positions within certain teams. So some games may be better fitting for props, some may be better fitting for backs. So the nines is certainly focusing on the quicker players. So that's really where you're going to bring up, promote the quicker players and bring it into the game, really. So, it, like you said, it's getting bigger. And I think it's an amazing way to promote what England, and not us, only us, but what other countries have.
And as someone who has, if anyone has seen the clips of you scoring tries on social media, has seen, you are one of the quickest players in the game out there. So that must be make it even more exciting for you, the chance to just sort of continue running, continue scoring great tries.
Yeah, like I said, it's loads of space. It's a full pitch with only 9 players on the field. So I'm really, really excited for it if I do get selected for the main squad. But not only that, there's a lot of quick individuals in the England squad. So I think it'll be great to see from our perspective.
This is another feather in your cap and another extraordinary achievement for an extraordinary 18 months or so, which has seen you catapulted from the Leeds Rhinos Academy to a full-time, a full England international. I guess going back to sort of January 2018, could you ever have believed you'd be in the position you are right now?
No, definitely not. Like you said, I originally started from the under-19s, and I would train a few times with them, and I remember one time the main team wanted to look at the 19s train. So we trained with the first team, and that was the first time I got to meet all now my teammates, and it were amazing to first get into the first team, because that was something I definitely didn't expect so early on, with me not playing any games for the 19s. But for the England call-up, I'd have never imagined it. Don't get me wrong, it was a massive goal of mine, but I'd have thought it was miles ahead into the future, not at this age.
And you mentioned their age. I don't know if we've said it previously, and certainly you wouldn't be able to tell from speaking to you, but you are just, you're still in your teenage years. I think you're 17, am I right in thinking?
Yeah, 17, 18, as we set off for the nines.
I guess, is that something that you feel sort of actually plays to your advantage, and that you're still so young and you're just excited and just bringing a raw energy to the game?
I tend to not treat it any different, and at the same time, I hope my other teammates do. I'd hope that age doesn't come into their view of me. But at the same time, I think it may come into it may be an advantage of mine, because as a young one, I try and train as hard as I can. I play as hard as I can because I'm aiming for that call up. Whereas people probably they're used to it and they're underestimate the young talent coming through. So hopefully it does play to my advantages, but I wouldn't use it, if you understand.
Yeah, of course. And another thing that has happened to you very recently, indeed just a few days ago, was that alongside your teammates at Leeds, you won your second Challenge Cup in as many years by overcoming Castleford Tigers in the final. So, as I said, they're a second trophy. And how did it feel winning this one, and how did the feeling sort of differ compared to the first one?
The first one, it were a great setup. Don't get me wrong. I think it was Warrington. Yeah, it was Warrington. It were a great setup, and it was our first cup as a team that we were going for because we've only just formed. And I think that's where Leeds really came together, and we really fought for that spot, especially against Castleford, who were a team that had been up for quite a few years. So it were a good test. It were a good test of both sides, and especially playing against such big names from both sides, such as Lewis Farcell on our side, who scored a try as well as myself. The game just kept on growing and growing, but nothing compared to this year playing at Bolton, playing a triple header. And I think this year we went into the game the underdogs, without Castleford are doing that's sort of ripping it up in the league. So I think people thought it was going to favour Castleford. So I think that's where that came to our advantage. And again, we won the cup.
And what was the sort of feeling in and around Leeds and the whole Rhinos fraternity afterwards? Like there seemed to be a lot of love from so many people on social media for the whole team.
Yeah, recently we're getting a lot of followers, and I think, for example, that playing it at Bolton, that's massive. That's a massive promotion for the women's game, and I think with 4,000 there watching, it's a record for women's rugby league. I think that's fantastic for the game, and hopefully if we can build on that and it can keep on growing. But in Leeds area, our support's getting bigger and bigger, and I think with us playing at Headingley a few times this year, we'll hopefully raise more profile to our team. It was absolutely fantastic. The coaches were massively proud, as well as the fans, as you said, on social media. It's just been great to look at. Not much criticism at all. It's all praise.
Going back to something you mentioned there about how the following for the team is growing significantly, I know you're very, very new still into the setup and you're still very young, but how much is the women's game growing in terms of popularity and participation, not just in Leeds, but across sort of the whole of the region where rugby league is played?
This shows how much it is growing. When I was younger, I've been playing since I was 6 years old, and the only people I could really look up to were the males, were people playing Super League. So I think now young girls have people to look up to, have people to aspire to be. And I think that's absolutely fantastic for the game. And I think that just goes to show how much it is growing, how much people are wanting to be a part of it. There's so much great talent coming through the systems at any level, at any club. Especially with the tours this year, I don't think anyone's had tours like it, especially from the World Cup last time. It was in Australia, but that's a World Cup. But the annual tour and just a Nines tournament, I think that's absolutely fantastic for the promotion of women's game.
Another fantastic promotion for the women's game that's coming up is the next World Cup 2021, which is being played over here. And how crucial do you think sort of not just the tournament itself, but the build up to that will be in actually cementing women's rugby league as a major player in women's sports in this country?
It's going to be a massive opportunity to play at big grounds, and playing for England, anybody, or playing for the country, I think it's massive for it to happen in England. And I think that, like, again, it's going to massively raise the profile and get more people on board. But as you can see, RFL are already promoting it and getting any kind of promotion that can behind it, whether it's not only the women's game, the men's game, wheelchair, PDRL. It's all massively growing because of where it's further coming in the future.
Another way in which the tournament could really kick off support for Women's Rugby League, especially, and the sport as a whole, is potential BBC coverage. I know that at the moment they're having the whole big hashtag Game Changers Summer. I know last year the Challenge Cup final was broadcast on BBC Sport, and I believe this year's one was as well. And how crucial is TV coverage in terms of, you know, growing the game and making it reach even more people and creating role models like yourself?
It is huge. I think, except from like the Challenge Cup finals, the most media and television time we get is the Owl League app, which, don't get me wrong, it is a massive app. It gets a lot of views. But hopefully television can come into it one day and we can build from that. And it were amazing to see the amount of views that BBC had and the build-up going towards the game. Like, for example, I went on Up North, and a few of my other teammates went on different news programmes and stuff like that. So the build-up to the game were huge, and I think it were perfectly... It were needed for the way that the game were played. It were an outstanding game. It really, really, really promoted the women's game in an absolutely phenomenal light, a lot of people would have thought that women's rugby weren't to that level or they haven't seen it before. So it's great to get people in the first game, maybe. That's what we were saying as a team, that 4,000 people ended up coming to our game. So most of those people might not have ever watched a rugby game, and some others may have brought their little daughters to come watch, and hopefully they've been inspired to make it to our level one day. So if that could be broadcasted all over the country through television, then that would be absolutely unreal.
And for you as players, what's it like with all this sudden increase in media attention? I know some of the younger players, this is sort of fairly normal for you, but for the players who've been around for a few years, is it quite a big difference for them just having so much more media opportunities?
Oh, we were actually talking about this the other day. I've been lucky enough to come into it at the best time due to my age. But other ones, it were hardly ever broadcasted, hardly ever promoted. And I think that's why I was missing out. As a kid, I didn't really know that there were women's teams around. I used to play in a lads team and went to a local girls team. And there weren't many names to look up at, and I think that shows how much the game has grown to see that there is Women's Super League now, that such as Leeds Rhinos and Wigan and Bradford, and people are playing in stadiums, and that's raising the profile again. So I think they can a change on not only the supporters' side but the players' side, and I don't think they expected it to chew off this quickly from how long they've been playing.
How important is it that teams like the Leeds Rhinos, the biggest names from the men's side, are now putting so much faith and support and time into developing women's teams? Is that something that you also feel is really crucial for helping to grow the sport that much further?
I think it's very crucial. Like, for example, we've got the 19s team, and that's really feeding into our first team, and it's making it a lot bigger, and it gets the men involved, such as our coach is Adam Cuthbertson, and I think he's the only Super League player to coach a women's team in the Women's Super League, and that's massive promotion for our team. I know that is, because a lot of people like to look at Adam as well as our team in general. And I think it's great from our perspective to get it from a player's point of view. It's all right getting it from a coach, but when was the last time they played compared to Adam, who plays week in, week out? for the same club. I think it's just massive, as well as the club backing us.
As well as Adam, there was a lovely photo doing the rounds on social media the other day, or two photos of yourself and Jamie Peacock as well, presenting your shirt just 7 years after there was a photo of you and him at a camp together. How special was that moment to you to share that with him?
As soon as we saw him there, obviously since a young age, as I've already mentioned, it's been a massive inspiration to me for not only the way he plays, but how motivational he is on the pitch. And I think you could tell that with the way he played. It was just a massive character on the field. So it was always someone that I looked up to as a child. And then women's rugby came, and I started to look up to not only men like Jamie, but people like the women like the people I play with now. Getting presented with my shirt from Jamie again was unreal. The fact that he, on a few camps, we know about 8, 9, it just shows how much everything's grown, and I'm sure he feels happy. The fact that he has pushed me in the right direction, he's helped me get to where I am, even though a few camps, it still goes to show how much people can get inspired at such a young age. It was honestly great. I loved it.
And Jamie is one of so many people who've done such great work, bringing players like yourself full circle from camps to full-on internationals. And you said previously you first started playing the game aged 6. How did you get involved? Was it that you'd seen on the TV and you wanted to get play a part of it, or was there a family or influence in there?
Well, family influence. My uncle used to play for Leeds a long time ago, but they were on about, my mum and dad were on about getting my brother to play, and it were kind of what about me moment from myself. So they didn't see a problem with it at all. So they took me and my brother down. He's my twin brother, so we played for the same team for years, and it really just went from there. And obviously the TV, watching games on the television were a massive part of it, because that's where you start supporting rugby, and that's where your aspirations come from. So it was predominantly family, but the promotion of the men's game really helped mine and my brother's decisions.
I can imagine, therefore, with you and your brother playing, that was quite a competitive household to be growing up in.
I can give you that one. It definitely was.
How much, though, do you think that being in that situation, having a sibling who was exactly the same age, playing the same sport, and someone to practice with and someone to beat effectively in the back garden, how important was that for your development?
You know what? He is massively supportive, especially of everything I've done, and I hope that he sees me in the same light. Like you said, we're always in the garden, passing a ball around, kicking about, because it might just be a bit of messing around, but it's still building on the confidence, it's building muscle memory, and that's going to hopefully get us somewhere someday. And he's made it to quite a high level himself at a young age, so I love seeing him growing his playing, and I hope that he feels the same with his support that he's been giving me for the last few years. So very competitive in the house at a young age, but I think it's leveled out now, and I think we're both very supportive of each other, and I hope that keeps growing.
A lot has been made in the media recently of the success of Phil Neville and Tracy Neville. Are you hoping that perhaps it's you and your brother who are getting a similar level of coverage and adulation one day?
Oh, definitely. I think that would be outstanding. It's something to look forward to.
It's not just on the field in terms of playing where you've been excelling, but I guess you were first brought to my attention through your officiating role as well, which I know you do a lot of and you're also fantastic at. And you made history last year by becoming the first woman to referee a rugby league game at Wembley Stadium. What an occasion. How was it for you?
I I didn't find words to describe it at first. It was something that we looked into before when I first got told, and like I said, it was something I just couldn't believe. It, as you can, and like you've said, it was such a big thing to hold, and such a big event on the calendar to do it as well, especially Wembley on Challenge Cup Day. It ended up getting packed, and at the end of the game, someone just told me to look round, take a minute to look round, and I had no words for the occasion. It was just something. It was something special.
How do you prepare yourself to officiate at such a big stadium, knowing that, as you mentioned there previously, that there are going to be a lot of packed crowds? Is it? Do you have to do anything differently, or was it just sort of focusing on yourself and trying to ignore everything else that was going on around you?
Yeah, like you said, for me, it is just focusing on yourself and your own performance. If you can, get stuck into the game as much as you can, because everything won't matter. You're there to do a job, and that's what I saw it as. Get the job done, then you can have your moment. And that's certainly what it was. I was there to do a job. Hopefully, I did it at the best I could. And it, not only that, the team that the officiating team that I had was outstanding, and at the end of the day, I couldn't have done it without them. They really made it special for me.
And how was the game itself? Was it a fairly straightforward affair, or were there a few difficult decisions to make?
I think every game is going to have a few difficult decisions, but except from a few 50s, as you can imagine, it were a great spirit game. I think both sides really did their schools some justice, and that's what we need in the game, because people, especially they're in year seven and they're playing a game at Wembley opening for the Men's Challenge Cup, they're going to be looking at after those players that come on after them and thinking, wow, I've just done something at my age that they're doing now at such an extent. So I think it is massive for them. But no, it was just a great day all around.
And what was it that made you want to take up officiating in the first place?
I originally, like I said, I went from a lads team. And when you're in a lads team, you've got to stop playing before you're getting under 12, so 11-year-old. So I went to a girls team, but they folded. And I were out for maybe a year or two. And I thought, I want to do something to do with rugby. I want to stay involved. Obviously, it's been a massive part of my life since I was 6-year-old. I want to carry on. So around 12, 13, I took up the whistle. And it's the best decision I've ever made.
How do you find the time to not only train to play yourself, but then also manage to fit in refereeing as regularly as you do?
I don't have any time, honestly. It is very hectic, but I wouldn't be able to do most of it without my parents and my family and all of that, and the support from RFL and Leeds. They're both very understanding of the different commitment that I have, such as RFL understand what Leeds want and Leeds understand what RFL want within my aspirations towards the future. So I wouldn't be able to do it without my parents. They'd be massively supportive.
One area in which women are still really underrepresented in sport is officiating. We've seen growth in terms of fan support from women, and we've seen growth in terms of participation, but not as much in terms of officiating. And I was just wondering, sort of, how can we in sport encourage more women to actually get involved in not just playing, but also sort of taking up a whistle or a flag?
I think it's a confidence thing, really. With me playing at such a young age, I've always been brought up with the rules. So I think for a women's aspect, it would be just them being quite hesitant with being authoritative with confidence on the rules. But I think that could soon change if they'd see positive comments with the officials and they'd want to learn. But at the moment, I think that it's a bit negative within the RFL and the support from crowds. But I'm sure that'll soon change. And I think that's where numbers are really, really get picked up. And I think that's what we need within the game. We need more numbers, we need more support, and 100% we need more confidence within our officials, and that's what we're going to get when we start backing the officials instead of certain supporters.
And there was a big moment just a few weeks ago in the NRL with Australia's Belinda Sharp becoming the first woman to referee a game in that league. How important a moment was that for promoting female officials in rugby league?
For me individually, it were massive. I've been keeping an eye on her come through the ranks, and the one a while ago was touch judging, and even then touch judging in an NRL match, I thought, wow, that's something I want to do in the future. But credit to her getting put to referee again. I think that's absolutely incredible for with the promotion of women officials, and that's what we need, and we need to keep building on it over here especially.
And in the way you were looking at Belinda Sharp and the others, a lot of people are now going to be looking at you as a role model in terms of officiating. Is that something you think much about at all?
For me, I'm there to do my job, and if people can look at me and be inspired by what I do, then I'm happy. It's a win-win. But if promoting female officials can come through me, then I wouldn't mind that at all. I'll put my hand up to that, as well as other female officials that are coming through. If I can help them with, even if they have a question, I'll try and be there and answer all the questions, because at the end of the day, it's all about building and promoting.
And going back to the overall sort of theme of this interview, in that this is such an exciting time for Women's Rugby League in this country. Over the next few years, how big could you see the sport becoming in terms of in national coverage and, you know, the numbers of women participating in the sport?
I'd hope that it'd get very big. For example, NRL, their games are getting televised not only over there but over here, and I think that's absolutely huge. And I think our game over here, the Women's Super League, will definitely it'll increase in support and being promoted on the TV and social media, and I think it'll all soon come in. But at the end of the day, it is all about the commitment to supporters. And if they're going to commit to it, if they're going to work hard and earn for our rights to be on that screen, then that's what we need. But first, I think the women's game in itself, certain bits need to adapt. So hopefully they'll come first.
Well, thank you so much for the interview, Caitlin. I can safely say this has been one of my most enjoyable on the podcast, and I genuinely am so excited to see how your career develops, both as a player and as an official. And thank you for coming on the show, and genuinely so excited to see how you do in the England shirt and a lead shirt going forward.
No, thank you very much for having me. It's been very enjoyable.
You're listening to Sportspiel, available on Audio Boom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's a big thanks again to Caitlin for taking some time out to speak with us on the podcast. We always appreciate when athletes and sports people do take so much time out to speak with us, and because it's what we love doing, essentially, is what we like bringing to you, the listeners. Moving on now to our second part of the show, and it is the news roundup section, where myself and Will take it in turns to give you a piece of news from the last couple of weeks that may have been underlooked or gone under the radar, or is another big news feature that we really think we should highlight and bring to people's attention. It was very much a quickfire round. We have the 2-minute timer, as always, with the wonderful duck alarm when we've gone past our 2 minutes. That is at the ready, I do believe. We're on stopwatch duty. So, kicking off the news roundup, this time is myself. And we'll start with Hope Solo, the former US goalkeeper. On July 29th, she was, of course, a pundit for the BBC during the World Cup as well, so a lot of TV viewers over here will be very familiar with her now. She has called for legal sanctions against her former teammates and their lawyers for rejecting her bid to be part of the equal pay mediation with the US Soccer Federation. As reported by The Athletic, Solo said in a very strongly worded motion that if her teammates brief on Friday, that's today as we record, to exclude her from the mediation is not stricken from the record, the document would, quote, continue to cause Solo humiliation, vilify Solo's persona, mischaracterize Solo's causes of actions and filings, and cause irreparable harm to her character and reputation. Remember then that 28 past and present US women's national team members, with Alex Morgan as the lead plaintiff on that case, they are suing US Soccer over their compensation, and they don't want Hope Solo as part of their equal pay mediation that is due to take place. So the mediation was agreed by the 28 and the US Soccer Federation before the World Cup started. And it was scheduled to take place once the World Cup had finished. Of course, it's just under a month now since they won the tournament, so that mediation is to come. But as I think I tweeted when the story initially came out, it does kind of show Hope Solo's controversial character, let's say. I think we all approved of her as a pundit. She made a lot of good points. But her as a character with her former teammates, still a little bit icy there. And let's not forget her international career. There goes the duck. Great. Her international career did end with a suspension as well, following the Rio Olympics.
Has there ever been a specific reason given as to why they don't want her as part of this group?
Not a specific reason given that I can find. I could guess at some reasons.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, we all know she's obviously had form for being controversial. She does have a couple of DUIs, I think, as well. It was just very strange because she's always come across as this quite fiery character who is very controversial. But then seeing her as a pundit during the World Cup, I thought she was really good. She made a lot of intelligent points. She wasn't afraid to state her opinion, but it was always very measured. And then
that was her case.
It was very strange.
That was her case for being part of the mediation in the first place, is that she thinks she's, I suppose, stronger than the other group, and will be able to hammer home her point more to the US Soccer Federation than they will. And the fact that she's not playing as well, she doesn't think she would fight solely for herself, whereas some of the team who are still playing would still have their international careers perhaps in their mind, is the point she's trying to make as to why she should be included in that.
It'd just be very interesting to know exactly why they're not interested in her.
Again, I think we could hazard some guesses.
We can indeed. My turn. So, it's not been a great summer for England's women's cricketers, let's be honest.
No.
Somewhat of a humbling in the Ashes series that concluded earlier this week saw England lose by 12 points to 4 across the multi-format series. That is the joint heaviest margin of defeat since the multi-point format was introduced. Australia previously lost 12-4 in England back in 2013. Australia have therefore retained the Ashes for a third consecutive series, and let's be honest, they were a class above England. It was interesting the way the two teams were playing, because it felt like watching the England's men's side that flopped so badly at the 2015 World Cup playing the England men's side that recently won the Men's World Cup earlier this year. It felt like Australia were really playing an attacking, inventive, clever, intelligent, progressive style of cricket developed from a 2020 basis but adapted to suit all formats of the game. Whereas it felt like England were playing a much more safer, old-school format. which has been successful in the past, saw them win the 2017 World Cup. But 2 years before then, when Charlotte Edwards was still as captain, there were a lot of issues, especially with the batting, and they seem to have reared their ugly heads once again. It just feels like England are playing too safe, and they're not... They're taking risks, but they're taking risks at the wrong times, almost. It was quite refreshing to watch Lauren Winford and Catherine Brunt batting at the end of the 2020 game that England won to secure some respectability to the scoreline. And then they were just trying different things out. They were moving around. They were putting the bowlers under pressure, which was something England's batting hadn't done previously. And then in that game, Maddie Villiers coming through, making her T20 debut or international debut, performed really well. So some good points for England, but there's a lot to be changed, and they need to build on the Australian model.
I think you mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when I saw you. Was there a failure to build from that World Cup victory in 2017?
You look at the Australian team, and this is a side that there's a core nucleus that's been around for a while. So Nicole Bolton, Elise Villani, Alyssa Healy, Meg Lanning, Elise Perry, Megan Shute. But then they've brought in a load of new, exciting, young, dynamic players. Beth Mooney, Ash Gardner, Sophie Molyneux, Georgia Wareham. And they've become first-team regulars straight away. Whereas England have got a core nucleus that has been the same for a number of years now. And there are very few new players coming in. And I think that is because of the investment that's been put into the WBBL is seeing more superstars coming through and is seeing the superstars they've already got progress their game and adapt and become better players for it. Our Kia Super League isn't given anywhere near as much attention or money over here. Women's County Cricket until recently was going to be scrapped entirely for next year, therefore cutting the pool of potential players massively. But the ECB have kept it quite under the radar, but they're making a number of changes and then reviewing that, which is good. It's a positive move. And then we've got the 100 coming in next year, which I'm not overly keen on. But if that means it's an opportunity to invest and grow the women's game so England can reach Australia's level, then that's a good thing. Because let's face it, England are the second best team in the world. They've proved that. Series against the West Indies recently, against South Africa and New Zealand last year, clearly better than all of them. India, I would say, are probably not too far behind, but then the chasm between the rest and those two is massive. And then the chasm between England and Australia is huge, as we've seen in this series. England are capable on their day of beating this Australian team, and they do have two of the best players the game has ever seen in Lanning and Perry. But there is a gap that is growing, and the game needs investment because the players are there. They just need that help that the Australians have had that we haven't had.
An example there, not to sit still. Speaking of sitting still, I come on to my next story. Hope you appreciate that link.
It's beautiful.
It's very amusing because some angry South Korean football fans are seeking compensation after Cristiano Ronaldo, we all know him, failed to take to the pitch during a Juventus pre-season friendly. The Portugal forward was contracted to play 45 minutes when the match against K-League All-Stars was announced, but he stayed on the substitutes bench throughout the entire game. Fans were very angry about that. They went so far as to chant Lionel Messi's name during the game, which is a little bit awkward, and some of them have now also filed a lawsuit. They are seeking compensation of 70,000 won, which is about £48.50, the cost of the match day ticket. They also want 1,000 won for the ticket commission fee and 1 million won each for compensation for mental anguish. Which, I really love that phrase. It shows just how passionate they are about Ronaldo. I think the talk is as well, he refused to come on in that game, which is a little bit awkward, but shows just how fanatical some people can be about football and their superstars. Whether this lawsuit will actually come off or not remains to be seen.
Does that mean I can sue our athletes at England, Great Britain Hockey whenever they lose for the mental anguish they cause me?
Every time you suffer mental anguish, God, West Ham probably owe me about £1,000 worth of mental anguish, if not
only,
more.
Only a thousand.
I'm just thinking in the recent future. Think of the two seasons I saw them get relegated. I could buy a house with that.
Speaking of sitting, we're going to continue with that theme, but sitting at pace now, if that's a thing. But history was made at Glorious Goodwood this week, as Khadija Mela became the first person in the United Kingdom to enter a competitive horse race while wearing a hijab. And not only that, she won it as well, beating the likes of Victoria Pendleton and several other celebrities in the amateur race. What makes her achievement even more impressive is that 4 months previously, she'd never ridden a racehorse.
And not
she
bad.
Was quoted as saying after the race that this was the fastest she'd ever gone. It's not like she is completely new to racing. Khadija has ridden horses for a lot of her life, but obviously this is a slightly different method of travelling around on horses, but it's a fantastic result, not just for her, but also for Muslim women in sport in the UK. I think their foundation have previously said that the number of Muslim women to have ever been professional jockeys is in single-digit numbers, and I think this is a fantastic opportunity for her to sort of do something different and really promote herself on the international stage. She's now going to go forth and try and obtain a professional license, and it's just brilliant to see an underrepresented group getting an opportunity, and she's delivered, and it created headlines. It was on the BBC Sport. You had the likes of Frankie Dettori giving her lots and lots of praise. So a really positive step forward in the world of horse racing.
It got a good amount of coverage for that. Moving on to my final story, which also got a lot of coverage and has done for several months, if not years now, and it's Caster Semenya. The IWF this week said that biology has to trump gender identity after welcoming the decision to permit restrictions in testosterone levels of female runners. So double Olympic champion Caster Semenya, she twice appealed against the new double IAAF rule that prevents her running the 800 metres without medication. A Swiss court suspended that ruling, but it is now being lifted, though Semenya had already said she would not be defending her world 800 metre title this year. The IAAF said competitors now have parity and clarity before the championships in Doha, which begin on the 28th of September. We already knew she wasn't going to be going to defend her title, but we did a discussion episode or a discussion section on this a fair while ago now, when it was first coming out after this ruling. And it's such a tough one to contemplate, because you don't want to force medication on an athlete in order to reduce something that's not technically their fault. But then if you are also an athlete coming up against someone who has that natural biological advantage, I know there's conflicting research on it as well, then you can understand that point of view as well, which is why it's such a tough one. And there's no right answer, really. There's no answer that pleases everyone.
I think, as we said previously, the way this has been handled as well has not helped the situation. It's been a mess from the start and continues to be a mess. And it's, you have to feel for Semenya and other athletes in her situation here, because all they want to do is race, and they're having other people telling them what they can and can't do and telling them about their bodies and stuff. It's difficult, but as you said, at the same time, if I was a woman lining up on the start line next to Semenya, knowing she had such a physical advantage over me that almost rendered me incredibly unlikely to win, I would feel aggrieved at that as well. But you can't win. No one can win.
And it rumbles on.
It rumbles on. Another story that has been rumbling on, not for so long, but for a few weeks now, is the prospect of a British and Irish Lions women's team, which is, for me, incredibly exciting. Rugby has made such massive steps over the last few years in terms of participation and coverage and money put into the international teams, especially over here in this country. And so the talk of a British and Irish Lions women's team now is fantastic. We've already seen history made earlier this summer when the first women's Barbarians team was put together, and former guest Tamara Taylor was in one of those, at least one of those Barbarian squads, if not both. And they played against England, actually, at Twickenham, which was a fantastic occasion for everyone, and got some good coverage. It's been interesting the way that people have been talking about it. Sarah Hunter, the England captain, said if they are going to set up a Lions women's team, that it shouldn't run, or it probably shouldn't run, in conjunction with the men's. It should be its own standalone event. And there's been a lot of talk about potentially sort of sending them on tours to the USA and Canada, where rugby is a lot stronger than it is perhaps in the more southern hemisphere countries that the Lions normally tour for the men's game. And I just think it's really interesting to see where this goes, and it's really exciting. And Ben Calverley, back in June, said that it was a case of when, not if, a women's Lions team was put together. They have had meetings with England, Scotland and Wales federations, and they're due to meet with Ireland too. So it does seem like it's going to happen soon, and it could be a huge financial benefit to the game as well, because the men's four-year cycle generates an estimated £39 million turnover. So imagine even a quarter of that coming into the women's game through the Lions, how much of a boost that would be to us. So yeah, exciting times, and hopefully before long we will see the first women's Lions tour.
Exactly, and it does seem to be a matter of when, not if, which is always a positive thing as well. That brings an end to this news roundup on this episode. The discussion section is coming after this. A ban on gambling adverts during televised sport has now come into effect, with the Ashes at the moment being the first major UK sporting event subject to those restrictions. Last year, the gambling industry announced the voluntary measure in an apparent bid to address the mounting concern about the volume of gambling adverts on TV, particularly their impact on children and vulnerable people. Under the agreement, no gambling adverts will be shown during live sport for a whistle-to-whistle, inverted commas, period, which begins 5 minutes before the start of a match and it ends 5 minutes after. It, however, excludes horse and greyhound racing, as they are seen as intrinsically linked to gambling, which is, I suppose, true. So the start of the discussion really is it a good move, and is it enough to combat what is becoming a bigger and bigger problem in society?
It's undoubtedly a start. It's reducing the amount of gambling adverts that children are going to be exposed to, which has become a really worrying thing over the last few years. I was reading a piece earlier today, and it said that during the 2018 Men's World Cup, ITV, so who had sort of half the games across the World Cup last summer, had given 90 minutes of betting adverts from the start of the tournament until England played against Croatia in the semi-final, which is worrying because adverts are normally only maximum 30 seconds long. So to have had 90 minutes worth of adverts out of, I think it was 8.5 hours, an hour and a half of that was dedicated just to gambling, which is about 17%, which is a greater percentage than any other type of advert, is worrying. That not, and it's not just children, but also people who are fighting gambling addiction, then seeing it sort of thrown in their faces as though it's a good thing, it's a glamorous thing. It's very conflicting for them, and it's been a problem in society for a long time, and we're becoming more aware of it. And I think it's a start, but I don't think it's the be-all and end-all.
Yeah, I think because the restriction on gambling advertising was only lifted in, 2005 with the Gambling Act. And I think we're only now just starting to really fully understand the effects that has been having. And yet, the contradiction side of things, yes, you may now not be able to show these gambling adverts during a live sporting event, but if you're watching football, for example, Premier League football, half of the Premier League clubs have a gambling sponsor on their shirt. If you drop it down to the Championship, 17 of the 24 clubs in that league have a betting logo on their shirt. So that means of the 44 top clubs in England, 27 of them have a gambling sponsor. The biggest contributor, by the way, is Betway's £10 million deal with West Ham. Yay, my team. But again, even though you're not showing the adverts, this is still something that children, vulnerable people, are watching their stars running around with these adverts, essentially on their shirts all the time. Not to mention the advertising hoardings around a football pitch or any other sporting arena at the moment, which again, I think, contradictory messages.
In hockey, we don't, as far as I'm aware, in this country, we don't have any form of betting put on around our games. I think actually we have restrictions from the FIH on that. So there are sports hockey being one where there are already restrictions in place on gambling adverts and the availability of being able to see gambling advertised, but I think sport is football in particular is a sport where it seems to be highly prevalent, and the adverts were always synonymous with for example Ray Winston telling you your halftime odds for what's going to happen in the second half of a game and things like that, and it's making a sort of a serious adult thing seem like a bit of fun and a joke and something light-hearted, and it's just worrying how prevalent it's become. And I know gambling is a massive industry and the money in there is insane, but I do think football clubs need to start, and not just football clubs, other teams as well, it's obviously a main issue in football, they need to start thinking about actually who they're going to for sponsors, because with the way of the world nowadays, they are so influential and they are all role models in their own way, in certain ways. So I think perhaps money isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all, and sometimes they have to put morals first.
To kind of sum up what an issue it is at the moment, I know you went through some of the advertising stats before. There was a study last month that was commissioned by Gamble Aware, which is one of the charities running at the moment. And problem gamblers, this is what the study found, problem gamblers were 6 times more likely to have suicidal thoughts or to try and take their own life, and they could be 15 times more likely to do so. So that's 19% had considered suicide in the past year compared to 4.1% of the general population. And again, I know we kind of talk about it as a football problem, but it is starting to become a problem in other sports, because you look at the way boxing is trying to get into the betting market as well. And then there's also rugby league, because again, I didn't realise former Arsenal legend footballer Tony Adams is now the Rugby Football League president recently. And the league and the Challenge Cup are both sponsored by bookmakers. And Tony Adams is someone who's had alcohol and gambling addiction problems in himself. He's the founder of the Sporting Chance addiction charity as well. And he said, again last month, that Rugby League had to be careful to ensure that its relationship with the industry did not normalise betting for addicts, because that can happen a lot of the time. But one issue I wanted to touch upon as well, which isn't really tackled again with these latest measures, is the direct marketing, which a lot of the betting companies are responsible for, i.e. sending the customer an email or a text message, whatever, but usually email, advertising a free bet here and there, which, say, if you get that email 5-10 minutes before the game is supposed to start, does that have the exact same effect as to what an advert would?
Yeah, I remember I signed up to Coral because I wanted to just place a small bet on the Grand National, I think, in 2018. And that's all I just wanted to do, one bet, but then I didn't close my account straight away afterwards, and I was, for a long time, getting texts and emails offering me different, quite attractive offers. Oh, you get a free £10 bet if you do this, you get a free £20 bet if you do this, and I know I have a fairly addictive personality and I have to fight that. So for me it was a case of, okay, straight away closing the account and stopping them from sending the messages. But for other people it's a different prospect, and if they're new to gambling and they're sort of drawn in by it and they don't realise if the problems with it, or if like they have the addiction and they're trying to fight it and they're there being given these offers, it's really worrying. And I remember reading a story actually a few days ago about someone was trying to sue, or someone it was Ladbrokes Coral were being fined a significant amount of money, something like £60 million, because people with addictions and stuff were trying to stop betting with them, and they knew the betting shops knew to not let these people advertise because of their addiction, and they were supposed to sort of encourage them to stop and block their online attempts to place bets and stuff like that. But they had a failing of these duties, and they were still allowing people to place bets when they shouldn't have been. And this is a very worrying situation, and these companies need to again, as we talked about with the footballers and the sports teams, they need to think about how they're going about advertising gambling, because of, as you mentioned before, the risks of serious issues such as suicide.
So then one interesting development that happened in the last couple of weeks was the Save Our Shirt campaign from Paddy Power, when we all briefly thought that Huddersfield Town were going to have that god-awful kit with the bridesmaid-esque sash across it with Paddy Power emblazoned across it in big letters. And then 2 days later we found out it was a stunt and Paddy Power were sponsoring Huddersfield by unsponsoring the shirt. So that shirt now has no sponsor on it at all, which on the face of it certainly looks like a positive move, because that company's not being shown visually in front of people who are watching Huddersfield. I think it also goes out to their wider advertising as well on hoardings and things. But then did that move in itself generate publicity for Paddy Power?
Yeah, of course it did. That was part of the reason for it. But I think their thing about the Save the Shirt campaign isn't necessarily around gambling in sport as their main prerogative. It's more around stopping the outrageous sponsorships we are seeing on shirts and the outrageous logos. And I think the problem we're always going to have now is though that we know that until Huddersfield get a new shirt sponsor, that even if it's blank, we know that it's going to be because of Paddy Power, because we will all remember that stump. So it's, I don't know really what to think about it. I did enjoy it. I thought it was quite funny and it had us all guessing. And I work very closely with someone who used to be very heavily affiliated with the football club, and even he wasn't sure if it was a spoof or not. So it was interesting and it was fun, but at the same time, I'm not entirely sure what it will achieve in terms of gambling in sport.
For what it's worth, Ladbrokes owner GPC is also calling for an end to shirt sponsorship too. So that's another gambling company.
But that's only tackling shirt sponsorship. It's not the other ways of advertising that we're seeing in sport.
Which follows on to my ultimate question, really, to try and round this off, is what's the next approach? If we've now employed this pre-watershed ban on advertising during live games, and I say it's only during the live games because you can still advertise it in the build-up, say, and then stop it 5 minutes before the game begins, then what's next? Should it be a blanket ban? Should we start tackling the direct marketing that we mentioned? Or should we actually start to treat gambling addiction more seriously in the same way that we're starting to treat mental health more seriously? Because it's essentially the same thing.
Definitely the latter. We've seen the examples of professional footballers, the likes of Daniel Sturridge, Michael Owen, Joey Barton, are all people who have either been banned for gambling or have come forward and said they've had gambling issues. Paul Merson as well famously has had his demons with gambling. And if for anyone who saw the Harry's Heroes programme or saw how he actually relapsed into that addiction while gambling was going on and how upsetting that was for him and made it very real, an issue that perhaps a lot of us don't necessarily understand. So I think we need to focus on that. And I think gambling relies on sport. The gambling industry will die without sport, and that will lose jobs and will affect the economy and etc. So I think it's now a case of regulating how that is seen, how it is portrayed. I doubt we'll ever see a blanket ban, but I think there should be changes to the ways that we are exposed to gambling messages. And I think this blanket ban is a good start, but one thing I slightly am not quite sure about is the 9 p.m. watershed. So for example, you're watching a Champions League game, a lot of kids will stay up to watch a Champions League game if it's their team playing. That 9 o'clock watershed goes past, and if the second half is played, it doesn't start till 9:10, you could see a halftime advert with gambling, because of the 5 minutes or before and after thing is becomes slightly redundant then. I think the rules will probably need to change, but I think it's a good start. What about you?
Likewise, I think it's a good start, but I do think there has to be more regulation. The issues of gambling addiction do need to be treated more seriously as well. And I think before it's been pretty much a free-for-all in terms of advertising. It's been absolutely relentless over the last few years. And I get that it can be a good bit of fun if you're in control of it. But there are people who aren't in control of it and really don't need that thrown in their face. So I'd like to see more of a regulation in terms of the advertising, the direct marketing, and maybe just more education and more help out there for people who do have that issue, because I think that's probably ultimately what it comes down to, is that if you do suffer from a gambling addiction, the help, as we've seen with a lot of people who have mental health problems, just isn't really there in the way it should be. So we definitely need to look at getting those resources in place as well to help people if they do unfortunately fall into those circumstances. Get that sorted and maybe rein in the advertising a bit more. Then you've probably got a better situation in society than we do right now. So with that hopefully positive message, we bring the discussion section to a close. Now it's my favourite part of the show, coming up after this very short break.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel to find our episodes and other video content.
Okay, now it is time for Ask Alistair. Again, always weird referring to myself in the third person, but since it's your section to test me, take it away. What's in store this time?
So for people who maybe haven't heard of this bit before, I basically have two questions. Alistair has to pick one, and if he gets it right, he gets a point, and if he gets it wrong, he loses a point. What score are you on at the moment? Are you on 1.5?
Yes.
I think you got the last one right, didn't you?
That half point was key.
And then we put the second question out to the audience and ask you to give us your answer. So this week, your topics are javelin and tennis. And I've said this to you off air, I'll say it to you on air. I got the javelin one right straight off. And if you go for the javelin one, there's a chance to get a bonus point.
What was the other one again?
Tennis.
See, this is mind games at work here, everyone. Because you're tempting me with the bonus point. And by saying that you got the javelin. But in my head, I'm like, I don't know anything about javelin. Javelin.
It worked. Which is the only country to have claimed the gold, silver and bronze medal in the men's javelin at the same Olympic Games?
Well, this is going to be a punt. Russia.
Final answer.
Is it wrong?
Is it your final answer?
Yes, it's my final answer.
Geographically, you're not far off. But no, it's not the right answer.
Ukraine.
The correct answer was Finland.
I mean, that's a little bit off geographically. How did you get that right?
Because I've obviously watched a lot of javelin to know that Finland have a history of success in men's javelin.
Should have gone for tennis.
The bonus point would have been... Actually, you can if you get this right, you can still get the bonus point. In which Olympics did that happen? What year? I didn't get this.
2004.
1932.
Okay, I was well off.
Would you've got that? So you're down to 0.5 points, unfortunately. But you're still in plus territory, just about.
Plus.
Would you have got the tennis question then? And this is going out to the audience, so feel free to tweet us, Facebook message us, email us.
All of those things.
With your answers. In what year was Hawkeye technology first used at Wimbledon? It's quite a tough one.
That's a tough one. I probably wouldn't have got
I feel
that.
Like if you know, you know.
That wouldn't have been a guess as well.
So that is Ask Alistair complete for another episode.
Oh, joy. Anyway, we've got some final messages to come after this. Right, that is almost it for episode 39, the long-awaited episode 39. I hope it was worth the wait. Some final messages. We're going to be back in shock horror 2 weeks' time. We keep a promise. When we're getting back to our normal schedule, we're keeping to the normal schedule. So we'll be back with episode 40 on August the 18th. So that is, again, Sunday. We also may have a surprise guest presenter that day as well. So TBC at the moment, but it's in the pipeline. Also, some more exciting developments is that we went up to see our friends at Mintridge Foundation HQ in Corby the other week, which may or may not include some more guests, by way of their ambassadors, plus a few special live events that we get to go to as well to bring you even more content.
Lots of exciting plans formulated that day, so should be good.
Give it 2-3 months and all will be revealed.
Whoop whoop.
Other than that, I think that's pretty much it for this episode. Got any exciting plans coming up in the next fortnight?
I do, but don't want to jinx them.
Ooh.
Don't want to jinx them.
Oh, okay. I thought you were like teasing us and you couldn't say it because it was ultra secret.
No. Hopefully things will be changing for me before long, but yeah, don't want to jinx it.
Yeah, that's kind of a tease. I'm working this weekend. Then I'm going on a holiday. So I'm going to have a great 2 weeks. As of Monday, so tomorrow as this goes out, I am off until the following Thursday. And I'm going to Scotland. Yay. Hello, holidays. So I'll be back uber refreshed and ready for more. And with that, listeners, that wraps up this episode of Sportspiel. Do remember to give us your answers for the question on the Hawkeye at Wimbledon. We both got it wrong, so you can only do better. And until next time, we will see you very soon.